Montgomery, Alabama. He was educated at Phillips Exeter Academy and received undergraduate and graduate degrees at Harvard. He, along with our colleague Bill Miller, was a writer, staff member of the Reporter magazine, which many of you read in an earlier period, beginning as Washington editor and then National Affairs editor. He has taught at Princeton, at Wesleyan, at Stanford, and at the University of California at San Francisco. He's directed the Program Council of the Aspen Institute and served as senior fellow at the Aspen Institute. He received the George Polk Memorial Award and the New York Newspaper Guild Front Page, First Page Award for his writings and journalism. Served in the OSS in World War II and has been a member of numerous public groups. His public career began, I think, in the early 50s when he was Special Assistant Secretary of the Army. He's written numerous books, one on ethics in a business society with Marcus Childs, Dana, the Irrelevant Man, and several other works in addition to the two that we look forward to hearing him discuss today. It's a great pleasure to welcome Douglas Cater again to the Miller Center.
Thank you. Ken, it feels like coming home again. It's been several times now. I can't quite remember how many times I've sat around this table. And it gives an extra feeling of being at home to find my old dear friend, William Lee Miller, is now part of the establishment. I first remember when Bill came in out of the coal and carrying a manuscript into the Washington office of the Reporter. I believe the first one was called Piety Along the Potomac, swiftly followed by some negative thoughts about Norman Vincent Peale. And away he went as one of the really the flagships on that great magazine, which I still lament its passing. Oh, to be young again and work for the Reporter. Instead, I just finished 5 years as a president of a small college, 10th oldest in America. It is a significant, historic little college. And I do think it has been a challenging period. This summer, I took a semi-sabbatical after 5 years to think about how much longer I wanted to endure these 8-day work weeks. And spending a great part of my life on my knees, not praying, but begging, which is the fate of the small college president. And while doing that, I did begin the revisiting of the two books that had marked my sort of beginning as a political punster. Backseat Driver in the Washington Press Corps. I worked for a fortnightly magazine, and so it was my opportunity to watch the press watching government. In fact, I hadn't even heard of Marshall McLuhan, so I lay claim to being slightly original in having written the fourth branch of government, which was an attempt to fit the working press into the schema of the larger governance of in America. And so it was this summer that I began to sort of rethink these in preparation for a book that's in progress. I'm glad I missed your retrospective on LBJ, because even though it's been, 20 years since I left him, or he left me, I'm still trying to make up my mind about that experience. I had a great love-hate relationship for Lyndon Johnson, and I still have found, I find it hard to find just the right words to describe what it was all like being there in the White House during that period of of triumph and tragedy. But anyway, I called Ken short time ago and said, which of my books would you like me to revisit? And we talked about one and then we talked about the other, and he absolutely refused to give even the slightest push in one direction or another. And I said, well, why don't we combine and revisit them both and call it something ambitious like Disorders in Government. Disorders in Power. Is that what we build this talk? And so let's see if I can get away with that. In starting, I'd like to say that in this year of our bicentennial of the real birth of America, I join in the celebration of the longest living written constitution still in force in the world. It was a miracle at Philadelphia, and we should not in any way minimize that. And yet we do recognize that we are under a living as opposed to a literal constitution, and that distinction has become even more relevant with the recent ordeal of Judge Bork. He has brought into national prominence the phrase original intent. And I would like to use that as a returning theme in the discussion this afternoon. 30 years ago, I wrote a book called The Fourth Branch of Government, which was I think one of the first to recognize that the press and the American system play an ongoing power role in the schema of government in America. A number of my journalistic friends were offended to be called a branch. They say we are totally independent, we're not beholden to government, and to call us a branch of government is demeaning. I think they overlook the fact that governing is a rather broadly consuming activity in America that extends out to the citizenry, and that the press could very well, in fact, in my opinion, more appropriately than other things that have been called fourth branch. The lobbyists used to be called the fourth branch. The regulatory agencies were called the fourth branch. I think the press is more legitimately a fourth branch. And then I wrote a book called Power in Washington, which was attempting to examine what happened since World War II and the way the organization of power works. It was a coincidence that I arrived in Washington as a young reporter for The Reporter the very same month that Senator Joseph McCarthy went out to Wheeling, West Virginia, and held in his hand either 87 or 95 or some number of communists, lists of communists that were then, in his words, infiltrating the State Department. And it was my experience to witness what Henry Adams called one of those periodic hiccups of democracy in which there was a disorder of power for a number of years. And it became clear to me as a backseat driver in the press corps that we were watching a new style demagogy. The old demagogue was the master of the stump speech who appealed to basic hatreds in a way that gave him popular appeal. McCarthy was not a very good orator at all, but he was a skilled expert at the timing of the release of information that would make news, of claims, assertions, charges, accusations. And he timed them in the time that the primetime television news was just beginning to become a regular phenomenon in America. He was quite skillful in dominating that glimpse of the cave wall of reality that television was providing to the citizenry. And for a remarkable number of years, he was able to stage his act so that it appeared to be center stage in Washington. And indeed, to in the latter years of Truman and the early years of Eisenhower to divert attention from the larger purposes that those presidents represented. It was that experience and others in watching government and trying to read my Constitution, not the way a hard-shell Baptist reads his Bible, but by indeed finding what is the living Constitution, that led to the reflections that were part of my book, Power in Washington. And I think it was most dramatically brought to me as the elections began to arrive and pass for president, that how far we had come from what Bork would call original intent. Original intent, about this time, a year or so from the time that a new president is scheduled to take office, we in this room might be talking among ourselves about who is the peer among us that really deserved to be our elector. And according to the Constitution, we would choose him by whatever method the state legislature had provided in our state. It could be a variety of methods. But having chosen him, or conceivably her, but in those days it was him, we would not allow him to go to Washington, where he would engage in cabals and factions and attempt to work out some sort of combine to pick the man who would be the chief magistrate. Instead, he would gather in the state capitol with his fellow electors from the state and send to Washington the name of the person that he felt most suited to be president. And by amendment of the Constitution, it was differentiated. He would also send the name of the person most suited to be vice president. And that was the way it was supposed to be. This was not popular democracy. I don't think the Founding Fathers had the foggiest notion of it becoming popular democracy. And yet it lasted only two elections. And then King caucus in Congress, abetted by Thomas Jefferson and Madison, who founded the Democratic Party to compete with the Federalists. And then we moved to the national nominating conventions, and then we moved early in the century and with renewal later in this century of the primaries, so that today we are fast moving toward the notion, and I saw it recommended in something I was reading this very morning, of a national primary day. Why go through all the agonies of separate primaries, which have our candidates chasing all over Iowa and New Hampshire, Super Tuesday in the South, which is supposed to represent the great conservative force of the South by having it all on the same Tuesday, and now they say Jesse Jackson is going to win it, which I find it's a different South from whoever planned that one. How far we have come toward the idea of plebiscitary democracy. And I even heard Jimmy Carter at a talk given up at the Gerald Ford Library say, when he had first witnessed the experiment of interactive television in Bucktown, where is it, Dayton, that they've got it? It's one of the Ohio towns that they've got a system by which you can have an instant poll on by a device on your television set, and Carter said how wonderful it would be if a president could make a speech and the people could respond that same evening to show their support for what he was saying. Went up to Mr. Carter afterward and said, "You really think that that's the way we should govern this republic, to by pollstering every night? But we've gone a considerable distance toward that now. All under the umbrella of this living Constitution." And indeed, what I'm saying would probably be regarded by those senators who voted against Bork as even more heinous. I could probably poll an even larger number of opponents if I suggested that we should take immediate steps to go back to the original intent of the Electoral College. And yet, I must confess that without being a conservative, in fact, I consider myself a liberal, I believe that the process by which we have arrived at the selection, at the winnowing and the selection of presidents has become so disorderly that it reminds me of Groucho Marx, who said, "I would not be a member of a club that would let me be a member." I would not be a president of a nation that would put me through the process that one has to go through to be a legitimate, bona fide candidate for president these days. And I saw Dan Evans of Washington, who was one of the men I really admired in Washington, D.C., I mean in the Senate, having been a three-time governor of the state of Washington. When he announced that he was withdrawing, I wrote him a letter and I said, "Tell me, is it because the political process is no longer providing the kind of satisfactions and encouragements that you expected?" I think we are witnessing in those who are not standing for president some significant signs that the business of presidential politics has gotten out of hand. One of the evidences of divine inspiration at Philadelphia was what was called the building of a constitution in which there would be separation of powers. Title 1, Section 1 says the legislative power shall be vested in the Congress. There is no mention in that paragraph of the president, except later on it is suggested that he would have a veto over acts of legislation subject to two-third override by the two houses. The living Constitution, on the other hand, since the time of Roosevelt and with continuing acceleration, the president is the chief legislator, and it is Congress which vetoes or modifies what is essentially the president's program and the president's budget. It's not the House that originates the revenue measures, it is the president who is expected to. And even when we have a divided government with a Republican president and a Democratic Congress, the Democratic Congress blames the president for not presenting a unified budget that is in balance. And the great effort now is to create a summit conference between the Congress and the president in which the matter of how to have a budget that begins to reduce the deficit is now the foremost center of attention. So Title 2, Section 1 says the executive power shall reside in the president. There is no mention in the literal constitution of congressional committees and subcommittees. And yet, under the living constitution, we have what I, in my book, called subgovernments, what political scientists have, later than my book, I claim, called the Iron Triangle, in which those in the executive, those in Congress, subcommittees usually, and those in the world of interest groups constitute within defined areas of powers an iron triangle to regulate the daily execution of decision making, so that it is no longer by any means clear that executive power is limited to the executive branch. Congress has no hesitancy in stepping into the decision making process. The Supreme Court, to everyone's surprise, suddenly 3 years ago or so, declared unconstitutional the explicit legislative veto, in which was permitted one or another house of Congress to exercise an ex post facto veto on the execution of a law passed by Congress. That, they said, was unconstitutional, going back to an original intent. But the daily oversight of Congress in its various manifestations of committee and subcommittee continues, so that there too the living Constitution is not what the literal Constitution foresaw. And then there is the limbo land, the territory that exists somewhere between Congress and the President. It says in the Constitution quite clearly that Congress shall have the power to declare war, and the Senate shall have the power of advice and consent, 2/3 over treaties. And yet, all the recent wars since World War II have been fought without declaration of war on the part of Congress, and the treaties have been largely substituted for by executive agreements. And now we confront the really murky area of the War Powers Act, in which Congress has not reclaimed to itself the power to declare war. What Congress wants to do is to come along 60 days later and say, that's a war, and now you have to call the troops home unless you can get us to declare war. So it's Congress, instead of reclaiming pristine its own power under the Constitution, it's saying we want to get in the act with the executive, or with the President as Commander-in-Chief, and in a sense second-guess the conduct and the development of war. And every president who has been elected since that War Powers Act was passed, including Mr. Nixon, who vetoed it, have declared it was unconstitutional, but nobody has figured out a way to have its constitutionality evaluated. How do you take that particular case to the Supreme Court? Do you get into a war and then go ask the Supreme Court, is this for real or not? Under the Treaty Act, we have the phenomenon of SALT II having been rejected, or at least never even considered by the Senate for ratification, and yet it continues to be abided by a president who says he really doesn't like it so far. And he, of course, is finding original intent in that SALT II treaty, which the people in Congress say was not there. And so there's again the threat of constitutional confrontation between the two branches, which nobody quite knows how to reconcile. Indeed, it's proposed now by some in Congress that they demand a subpoena on the executive to get the negotiating documents during the course of the preparation of SALT truth to see whether the president is telling the truth or lying when he says what the understandings were that related to the SDI, or the possibility of testing the Star Wars. And of course, if they do that, Congress will have taken one more giant stride into going behind what is called executive privilege, in which there is confidentiality at the very heart of the presidential decision-making process. I believe that, skipping ahead a bit in my outline, but I was greatly disconcerted when Mr. Reagan appeared before the Iran Gate hearings, and Senator Heflin of Alabama said to him, I understand you have waived your Fifth Amendment rights, and he said, yes, I have. He said, you've also waived your some other rights, I've forgotten them at the moment. And then Mr. Reagan said, I've also waived executive privilege. Well, I thought, where under the Constitution is a former deputy to a president given the right to waive executive privilege? I mean, first of all, executive privilege is nowhere mentioned in the Constitution, but it has been fought and has grown up under usage as the right of a president to put a cloak of executive privilege over matters in which he was involved, but it was certainly not thought of as something which a underling to a president could come up and say, I'm either claiming it on my own or I'm waiving it on my own. I wrote an article in the Washington Post on that subject which caused Mr. Regan's lawyers to get very angry at me. They said that I had not understood what he meant. Finally, we have Title III, Section 1, which says the judicial power shall reside in the Supreme Court and such lesser courts as shall be appointed. And yet, in this famous Brown versus the Board of Education, the Supreme Court was years ahead of both Congress and the President in declaring that fundamental policy that separate cannot be equal under the Constitution. And so here it was, that what is called an activist Supreme Court not only interpreted what is constitutional, but set a whole new dimension of equality under the law. And yet, this same Supreme Court appears to avoid, like the very devil, any attempt to adjudicate the power confrontations between the two other branches of government. Over the long list of Supreme Court daring do in decision making, you find very few times in which the Supreme Court has told one other branch of government that it was intruding on the power of the other branch of government. Harry Truman's seizure of steel was one of those cases. And more recently, the legislative veto was one such case. So I suggest that in the disorder of power in Washington today, we have two principal areas, nowhere mentioned in the Constitution, and therefore very difficult to find ways by which either judicial or other negotiation can work out the limits. One is what I call executive privilege. And in my opinion, both Watergate and Orangate led to a dramatic and frightening erosion of executive privilege. It turned out that within the White House proper, such things were going on that in a sustained competition for the support of public opinion, a president will find it very, very difficult to say, this is a matter too confidential for me to reveal to the Congress. And this, I think, for anyone who has been involved in the White House, and who knows what is necessary that must go on if there's to be free debate and during difficult decision making, that unless there is a considerable degree of confidentiality in the White House, I think it's going to be very difficult for a president, any president, no matter how well motivated, to do his job. And then the other area of controversy is congressional oversight. That word oversight is not mentioned in the Constitution. Thomas Jefferson did talk about the grand inquest of Congress as being a method by which Congress could keep the executive at bay. But the Constitution, the written Constitution, talks about legislative purpose as being to enact legislation or to pass revenue measures. Congressional oversight today, more often than not, has no legislative purpose in mind, but is designed to give maximum publicity to to the exposure and to, as a result, to the restraint of executive use of power. And when it is done well and wisely, it does provide one of those checks and balances which of which we are so proud in our system. But when it is carried to the point that Congress is pulling up the plant of policy before it is well planted and watered and nurtured, I think it can do fundamental damage to the wise and deliberative and necessarily slow and patient policy-making process. It creates a compulsion on the president and his minions to come up with quickie solutions, so they'll be one jump ahead of the game in the decision-making process. Richard Neustadt, in his celebrated book called Presidential Power, The Politics of Leadership, says that we really don't have a separation of powers at all under our Constitution, that what we have are separated institutions sharing powers. And I think the living Constitution bears him out. And it was under that premise that I looked at the fourth branch of government, the press, and looked at its role, that indeed, because these institutions are separate, not one of them, either the executive, nor Congress, nor the judiciary, is prepared to concede to the other one the principal role in the communication process. And this elects this unelected functionary, the journalist, who comes to Washington frequently with no more than a payroll and a license from his publisher to dig where he can. He is the principal means of the daily communication intercourse of government. Not only is he communicating to the larger publics beyond Washington, but he is more likely than not the one who first carries the news between the opposite ends of Pennsylvania Avenue. And in that giving priority to the flow of news about government constitutes the real power of the press, far more than any editorial power of its editorial page to say, we believe this or we don't believe that. I was satisfied when I wrote that book that I had made a a significant discovery, and I'm sorry I'm coughing. I don't know. Maybe it's your, I was going to say your roses, but I don't see any roses.
Points up the need for a dehumidifier.
And that indeed, after traveling around the world on a fellowship and comparing the way government related to the press in Britain and the Soviet Union in the new found democracy of India and in Germany, I came back more convinced than ever that in our system, in the American separated institution system, the press plays a peculiarly a significant role. What has changed in 30 years since I wrote that book? Well, when I wrote, TV was just intruding its nose into the door. I remember that how angry we print journalists were when Jim Hagerty permitted the TV cameras to come into the president's press conference. And if you remember, in his early years, he made them hold up their films for, I think it was a couple of hours. What you could do in 2 hours, I don't know, but one thing, you gave the print journalist 2 hours head start, which is what we wanted. And then, of course, under Kennedy, for whom television was created, he being the first of the genuine electronic media personalities, he had the gestures and the manner that suited television. live television coverage of the press conference, plus behind-the-scenes television coverage of a good many things going on in the Kennedy White House, became the norm. Today we have a president who is trying his best to figure out how to use television without having to deal with those pesky devils that are the TV anchor people and reporters. And he's doing, or he was doing, I would have said up until half a year or so ago, that he was winning that battle. Although we were more or less reconciled as a people, spending most of our life watching Mr. Reagan in this posture, as he either got on or got off of a helicopter, he was able to abolish the president's press conference as a regular mode of communication, one that had been honored under previous presidents, although some held them more often than others. But still, Mr. Reagan obviously only held them when he was good and ready, and yet he was what we feared when television was first invented, that at last the showman was going to turn out to be the consummate politician. He had a manner of talking that just you had to like him even when you hated what he had to say. And of course the polls showed that he was doing just swell. And then came the Iran gate, and then has come the subsequent things, and it looks to me as if he is going to enjoy the same fate of every president since Truman, except Eisenhower. Everyone has departed the White House, crippled by the experience of being president. So that in the master paradox is that in the age that we have said is the age of the imperial presidency, we have nevertheless had a succession of presidents except for this one wartime hero, and there's some debate on exactly his opinion ratings were at least up. We have not had a president who has stood the gaff of two terms of office and walked out with all of his vital powers intact. And I foresee the same fate for Mr. Reagan. I think he is on the slippery downward slope that one damn thing after another is hitting him. Once again, the great public is open for some new kind of leader who will emerge, who we can have trust in, confidence in, who we can really like, who will be the leader we are looking for. Beyond that, I find an awful lot to worry about in the age of electronic communication. The ideal, of course, is that the TV set has the capacity to turn America into a great Greek marketplace in which the citizens huddle before their living room sets and participate in the forum of democracy. The reality is that we have developed a whole new breed of public opinion manipulators, and they are the coterie which surround each candidate for president. No longer, when a man looks deep into himself and decides, yes, I should be your next president, he's not done it because his peers have come and fingered to him and said, George, you are the man. He's done it because there was some welling ambition within him, some driven compulsion that said, I'm prepared to spend the years and the millions of dollars and stand all the gaff to reach for the prize, which is the presidency. You remember when Mondale attempted to run the first time and back in the mid-70s, back in the pre-primary stage, he came out to San Francisco. I was then at University of California in San Francisco, and I went to a dinner for him, and I thought that evening as he spoke after dinner to a bunch of fat cats who had been gathered to begin the fundraising process, this man looks to me as if he's already lost heart. Well, about a, not Gary Hart, but his own heart. About a month later, he announced that he had withdrawn from this competition, and people remember him as saying that he was tired of staying in Holiday Inns. But they forgot, he also said, and I'm tired of arriving in communities at 6 in the evening and having to sum up my views on some weighty matter of foreign policy in 30 seconds or less for the evening TV news. And that, of course, is what the candidate is expected to do over and over and over again. And if he slips and repeats himself, or even worse, if he slips and repeats somebody else, he is consigned to ignominy. As Mr. Biden said, let he who is without sin cast the first stone. So, the age of instant communication, electronically, with the satellite and cable, which means we have it worldwide and we have as many channels as our hearts may desire, is creating an environment in which it seems to me the conduct of far-sighted politics, the kind that George Washington talked about in his farewell address, when he also talked about getting engaged in entangling alliances abroad, where that kind of far-sighted politics is very, very difficult. I've had the recent experience, I managed to get Pete DuPont, who's running for president, as you know, from Delaware and is just across the border from Washington College. He gave me 4 dates that he was willing to debate any Democrat who claimed he was running for president. He didn't care who he was. And I thought, well, I'll be able to have a nice little debate on my campus. Mr. DuPont represents a considerable conservative point of view. So I began to go after the Democrats. I couldn't get yes, I couldn't get no, I couldn't even get maybe out of them. They are all so fixated on Iowa and what will sing in Iowa that the notion of speaking in Delaware or Maryland is just beyond the not only their capacity, but the capacity of those cunning manipulators who surround them, and one of whom is figuring out how to manipulate public opinion polls. One is figuring out how to create television imagery. One of them is handling press relations. And that is the president's coterie. He does not communicate with other politicians. He plays a lonely role. It's a loner game nowadays. And it's loners who get elected presidents, like Carter and like Reagan. They're men who don't have a great deal of circle of intimates where they engage in the to and fro. And it was said of Johnson by George Reedy that his great downfall began when he got withdrawn from the hugger-mugger of the Senate, where he was used to being, as Reedy said it so eloquently, he was used to being told, go soak your head. Well, this is a brief enumeration of the things that I would consider disorders of power that disturb me. I do believe that TV does not have an ideological bias, unlike many people who think it's out to get Reagan or to get somebody else. If it has any mission, it TV journalist. It's exploitative. It is to expose the soft underbelly of public policy, the marathon mess of the business of governing. And it basically, in my opinion, those who succeed in TV journalism, unlike some of those who set the peer group attitudes when I entered print journalism, there's a basic failure of understanding about what the business of governing is all about. That even if a good governor were to turn up in the White House, I don't think the TV journalists would have the capacity to differentiate. And of course, with that comes the continuing incremental conviction that television spawns that the citizen should be the instant arbiter of every controversial issue that confronts government, no matter how complicated it may be, and no matter how long-term the solutions may be. It is the ultimate appeal to the people in the mass as sovereign. And it recalls the phrase that used to be popular back in the days of the founding framers, ochlocracy. Does anybody know what ochlocracy is? They use that word quite frequently.
No.
Ochlocracy. Demagogy of the masses. And they feared that in the same way they feared factions. I think that we're running that danger. And I say that as a liberal, not as a conservative. So here we have it. I don't have an ending point for this talk because I hoped it would be sufficiently controversial that I wouldn't have to end it. But by now you would have jumped down my throat. 200 years after the miracle at Philadelphia, the disorders of power are represented by the fear of the apocalyptic president, the president with the finger on the nuclear button, capable of bringing us all down, really without even consulting his own advisors. And opposed by that, the Congress of instant oversight, becoming more and more traditionally ruled by the other party, unless by some miracle a Democrat is elected to the White House and the Democrats maintain Congress, in which for the first time in a number of years we will have both branches of government under the same party. We witness the deficit themselves with, what is it called? The
Damocles.
Well, it's sort of Damocles, but what is the thing that will fall and automatically
Graham Redden,
Hollins. I went to a Governor Schaefer of Maryland, had a breakfast Friday morning in which he was honoring an author who wrote the book on excellence. What is his name?
Peters.
Peters has now written a new book and he dedicated it to Governor Schaefer, who he calls the mayor of Maryland because he's trying to run the state now the way he ran the city of Baltimore. And the title of the book I thought was really significant for our time. It's called Thriving on Chaos, which he defines as the new mode of leadership, not thriving amid chaos. He made the distinction. It's not just getting along through, it's thriving on chaos. So, perhaps that is the new polity that we are evolving to, is a system of governing that does thrive on chaos. I have yet to be convinced how that's going to work, I guess I am original intent man, although I would not have voted for Bork. And Ken, that is where I am in my thinking. I would be happy to try to defend it further.
I think we know where you're saying that.
Who'd like to ask the first question?
Ken, let me try.
Yeah,
General. You've seen the chaos that I've seen for a lifetime in Washington. How probable do you think a line item veto would ever get through so that an executive, regardless of his political faith, could some way or another manage the affairs of government?
I was on Lloyd Cutler, who you know, I believe, wrote an article in Foreign Affairs several years ago called A Form of Government, in which he was rethinking after his Carter years in the White House that the principal problem of American government is that when we elect a president, we do not form a government, and he was strongly influenced by his experience as a, I guess he was a Rhodes Scholar, but he certainly studied at Oxford, in the parliamentary system. So out of that article, he managed to get a coterie of associates and others, including as co-chairman, he got Doug Dillon and Senator Nancy Kassenbaum from Kansas as co-chairman of a what was called a Committee on the Constitution. I was a member, and we spent about 4 years meeting about every 3 months, usually for a whole day or sometimes for a day and a half. And we considered every amendment to the Constitution plus changes, organic changes that would not necessarily require an amendment. And at the end of 4 years, I must admit, we came up with a precious few under which we could either get consensus of support or any feeling that if we did, that there was a chance of their surviving. And of course, one of these was the line item veto. And I myself have mixed feelings. If you gave that power to Reagan, we know what he would do with it. We would have the military budget he wants and the civilian budget he wants. And I guess that's my dilemma, is that whereas I say I want a strong and purposeful president, I want him also to be somebody that I believe in. And that may be a contradiction. We examine other things. We examine the six-year presidency. Well, just as we're getting fully into examining that, the Iran gate came along, and that seemed to sort of peter out, and nobody pushed that very hard. We did reach a consensus that it would be valuable if we could do it, but there were the doubters, to have four-year terms for the congressmen, the representatives. But then it was felt that they would, and there were several senators on this committee, and they said that the congressmen would have to pledge that in their off year they would not run against the senator of their state, because if they did, the Senate would not ratify this amendment to the Constitution. The senators being really feeling that they should be in there for life. As indeed more and more congressmen are beginning to feel that. If you look at the elective turnover in the House of Representatives nowadays, it is few and far between. What mainly happens is either they get weary and sick, or else their retirement gets so much bigger than their salary that they, as Tip O'Neill did, he ends up being richer by leaving the Congress than by staying in the Congress. It's a rather cynical way of looking at it. But anyway, we decided that this modest ambition to have a four-year term for the House would just not cut the mustard in terms of the difficulty of getting the Constitution amended, which, as you know, takes two-third vote and then a three-fourths vote to get it done. President Johnson, and you may remember, I think in his second or third State of the Union proposed a four-year term. He got a standing ovation in the House, and they never even brought the bill up to consideration. So that's what happened to that.
Next question.
I have a question.
Sterling Kern.
I'd like to hear a projected remedy from you on the presidential selection process. It's obviously too expensive and too grueling, and very bizarre. And since coming to Charlottesville, I've had several conversations on the problem. Have you thought of a remedy for this?
If I had the kind of declarative power that something could be done and done swiftly so that it took hold, would say that the future would lie not in abolishing primaries, because I think they're too much like motherhood. The primary is supposed to be the grassroots. But I would say that each presidential election, and this would not require any constitutional change, it could be done by the party leadership in each party, but that you would have one primary rotated in each of the major regions of the country, and they would be held rather late. They would not start until, say, March of the year of which the election was going to be held, and that they would take place at scheduled intervals so that the candidates would have time to go from one to the other, and that would constitute the primary system. I would then say that as part of the general reform, you would say that the convention will be, the National Nominating Convention will be heavily weighted toward those members of that party who hold elective or appointive office in the party, with a minority coming from out of sort of the instant enthusiasm that gets behind one candidate or another. Those are the summer soldiers, the ones that are ready to work 24 hours a day as long as they are pushing George McGovern, but who fade back into the woodwork when somebody else comes along. And those are not the kind that build enduring parties. So I would tilt the convention toward the more professional politicians and away from the amateurs. Having done that, I would do all in my power to give respectability to the presidential debates, which I've worked very closely with the League of Women Voters in trying to make them into something worth doing. At present, they are a pawn. The candidate managers treats the league with loathing, as do the networks. They think these are meddling women that have gotten in the middle of the political process. And I would say that either the league or some non-political and non-press group should stage these things. They should be done, at least four of them, in the course of the final campaign. And I would think they ought to be held in Constitution Hall so as to kind of remind people that we are, we've got a long heritage for this country. I think they represent, the debates represent, one of the few fleeting opportunities we have to see a candidate living under his own wits. Most of the time we see him, he is, unless he's shaking hands and going through that kind of rat race of howdy doing, most of the time he is programmed by his planners, and we don't see the real candidate. The debates are not the greatest thing ever invented, but they're better than anything else that I can think of, at least, to provide that element of contest which the public likes, and the viewership of those debates prove that at least the public will watch them, whereas great many other things. I think politics is playing a losing game at the moment. With all the assistive television, it seems to me that the great American public is probably more apathetic toward the political process today than it was before the age of television.
What about spending limits?
Thank you. Yes. I would. There, I think the Supreme Court, which by and large is a sensible body, when it ruled as unconstitutional in the case of, I had it on the tip of
political the action.
What?
Political Action Committee.
Yeah.
Committees of the
it was, I've forgotten the name of the case, but anyway, it ruled that you could indeed set a limit on the amount that a citizen could give to an individual candidate who agreed to get under this subsidy compact, but you could not limit the amount he could give himself if he happened to be a very wealthy man, nor could you limit the amount that citizens could give to political action committees. And as a result, we've seen the proliferation of political action committees, which have the freedom to advertise a candidate in their own terms. And the candidate does, since he has no control over their money, has no way to say, no, that's not the real me they're talking about. I think it's a threat to the candidate, and it's a threat to the people that political action committees are given this sort of constitutional right to raise and spend their money without any kind of checks or balances. So yes, I would say that we would strengthen the present Presidential Campaign Financing Act and make it apply to all money that goes into presidential politics. And indeed, I would extend it to congressional politics too. Now that gets back to the primary system. There's obviously no way you can put in governmental subsidy into the congressional primary process. And there, I guess, all you can do is say that money is going to continue to play a very significant role in the way we elect our people to Congress. You remember the Senate, the amendment to the Constitution, one of the few amendments that went to significant substantive things of this sort, which declared that senators would be elected by popular rather than appointed by their state legislatures, was because they said we were having a Senate of millionaires. Well, we're back to that all over again. The Senate is a place for rich people, or either rich people or patrons of rich people.
Mrs. Griswold?
Yes, I want to ask a question about what happens before you get to that point, and that has to do with the quality of the field of candidates. I've been reading a great many kind words lately about the old party bosses.
Well, of course, that's always the way to de-minimize us negativists, is to say, look what the good old days, they weren't so good either. But when the political bosses operated at their best, they did measure the quality of the candidates. We got a lot of poor ones, I'll admit, over history. I happen to think that we would never be able, in this kind of open democracy we have now, to go all the way back to the political bossism of the old times, and that if you had people of authority in your political parties who were able to get together and as reasoning people in the back rooms finger the person they felt was the best prospect for the presidency, that I happen to think that would be a better method than the present method. you'll remember it was Dick Daley who chose both Adlai Stevenson and Paul Douglas as creatures of a political boss. And that one bird doesn't make springtime, but some pretty good people emerged under that backroom system. But I'm not for going all the way back to the backrooms, just partway.
Well, how would you feel about a candidate who wanted to run applying to the party under whose label he wanted to run and had them accept him or not?
Well, I have no objection to that.
Larry Hart might not have embarrassed himself and his party if he had done this.
But the question is, what is the application process? Is it like one of these clubs that won't admit women, or is it a little bit more open than that? By and large, I guess I labor under the romantic illusion that the man, the strong, silent person, not necessarily a man, who doesn't go around lusting for the presidency, conspicuously at least, he is more likely to be a good president than the one who somehow thinks, by God, I'm the best candidate possible. I think that we have seen in a recent run men who have, under test, stood up kind of miserably. I think Joe Biden reduced himself, at least in my eyes, in his past and present behavior. I thought even Dukakis was so waffling when it turned out that one of his aides had leaked that film. He was neither fish nor fowl that day. He couldn't make up his mind where he was, and that didn't look good for Dukakis at all. I happen to think that was no great sin if your aide shows a film of an opponent, as long as he didn't doctor the film, which he didn't. If I were Dukakis, I would have said, I don't particularly agree with my aide, but I'm not going to fire him because of this, and I'm sorry if anybody got his feelings hurt. That's the way I would have treated it. But we are getting other directed men now as candidates. I think my good friend at Harvard, David Reisman, never dreamed how other directed we could our candidates could become.
Any other questions? Stage, do you want to ask a question about presidential press conferences? What?
How often should they happen?
At least every 2 weeks. There is a... yes, I see you. I see no reason that they shouldn't be televised. It does affect strongly the behavior of the reporters. They all feel they've got to gussy up, and particularly the TV ones that are in intense competition. They can't let ABC get on without the other networks. So it has changed the good old days when Eisenhower, by the way, had one like rain or shine once a week. And of course, Roosevelt had them much more frequently. He just called in the press whenever he felt like it, and it was not a very formal thing. But Eisenhower was very religious. No matter what was going on, he held his press conference, as did Truman. And those were good times. We got to ask. I was a regular. We got to ask any question that we wanted. And the president usually answered. And the president in those days felt he had the capacity to say no comment, which is a legitimate answer to any question. If you don't want to answer it, you don't have to.
The successor group of the Miller Center, Harvard University's group that's looking into presidential press conferences, under the leadership of Marvin Kalb, is split on this issue. Dick Darman and Larry Barrett and several others think that televised press conferences have become irrelevant. Mm-hmm. And they're equally cynical on both sides. Dick Darman said packaging a candidate is exactly like packaging a product. Said they followed the dictum in the early years of the Reagan administration that someone told them one time, all you need to do is to show that face and a baby will cry. And they were totally cynical, therefore, in the way they managed the early press conference. And Darman said that this actually hurt communication to the extent that you can communicate on press conference. On the other hand, David Broder and UPI and AP and the other people that are involved, Jack Nelson, think that they still are a significant national event. So whether they resolve their differences or not, right at the moment there's quite a split.
Yeah, well, again, it's just like the old thing, how's your wife and compared to what?
Or husband.
Yeah. The presidents of press conference is sort of the best way we know, and as long as the president is not directly answerable to Congress as in a parliamentary system, it's the best way we know to periodically get in there and be sure he's alive and that he is still capable of forming coherent sentences, although that's not always true. Beyond that, if it's held periodically, I mean, with a fair degree of frequency, I think it can be a very useful way of a president communicating to the people. I guess we all harbor illusions. I really believe that if I were president, and mind you, I'm not lusting for the job, that I could handle a president's press conference, that I would know when to say, shucks, fellas, I'll look it up, but I just don't have the answer to that question today. I think I could be...
I don't think Dan Rather would let you get away with it.
Dan can't beat me up in too hard. There is a certain respect that is accorded the president by the people. And I don't know. I think the press are riding always a nervous thing. I've had three reporters call me in the last month. They were doing feature stories on whether the press had gone too far. And so that's become a subject of news features. It's a curious change. When I was a reporter, we were the down at the heel boys who did do a fair amount of legwork, and we used to having more or less to say sir to politicians. We didn't kowtow to them, but at the same time, a politician was a slightly higher. If we were invited to their house for dinner, we thought it was pretty nice. Nowadays, particularly a TV anchor person in Washington wears far better clothes. He has his tailor, his coiffure creator, and he gives the dinner parties to which politicians hanker to go. There's been a real turnaround in the social pecking order between the so-called stars of communication and the poor politicians.
And the dollars, too.
What?
And the dollars.
Oh, and the dollars, yes. It's when you see a TV anchor person talking about some matter of the poor welfare, downtrodden, and lecturing the callous politicians. Well, of course, you remember when I guess it was CBS that they had that big cut, and Fred Friendly, who had been president of CBS News, went on the Ted Koppel program and said, why don't you, Ted, and Dan Rather and every, give a third of your salary to help keep all these other good reporters from being fired. For once, I saw a couple speechless. I've been fairly negative this afternoon. I'm sorry. I'm not that negative by nature.
I wonder if the public would be better served if the format of the press conference could be changed to be more like Meet the Press, that you rotate ABC, CBS, NBC, the Associated Press, United Press, so that the few who are selected could answer, could ask more questions in depth than follow up. It seems to me with that great group of reporters that are asking questions, they're all so superficial. That is, you don't get to follow the trend.
Well, they've gotten great skill, which we didn't do as much of in my day, and saying, announcing when they ask their first question, Mr. President, I have a question, but I also have a follow-up. So they, in a sense, stake their claim before they've asked their first question. But yes, it would be true. There is, by the way, a certain interior thing that certain of the front bench boys and girls are going to be asked questions, and the folks in the back of the room at the president's press conferences only get called on at random. Now, I don't know why the president plays that game, because I would think sometimes he would get so mad he would do nothing but call on foreigners that he saw sitting around the table. But he does, and if you'll notice, every time there is a press conference, it's the so-called deans of the press corps who get called on first, including the wire services. Bill, you haven't...
Well, it's so stimulating, Doug, and I agree with it all. And Ken said make it short. Isn't one of the combination of the plebiscitary impulse very strong, fed by this new enormously important instrument, which is just coming in when you wrote Fourth Branch of Government. Not yet there in McCarthy, was it? Just at the end in 54.
McCarthy was hung by the...
Yeah, in 54, the Army-McCarthy hearings. But now the implications of the Fourth Branch of Government are this thing is so big, shaping the culture in which the politics set, that it is part of government, no way out of it. And it has it reinforces that plebiscitary thing, it reinforces the monarchical impulse to focus on the president. One sort of difference in emphasis I feel a little in what you say is the original institution most damaged by this development is Congress, mm-hmm. not the president. No. That's executives, and they focus and single, and you can control it. But Congress has no present way to make the essence of the legislative body, which is the core of that original thing, more important than the other, more distinctive than the other branches, because you've got other egos you have to. The one little, occasionally you can see glimpses of how it could work on C-SPAN, mm-hmm. which is the only good network because it's boring, and occasionally on the House Judiciary Committee hearings on impeachment. Sometimes you see Canadian television, Canadian Parliament television saying, now there the public would learn what a Republican government is like, mm-hmm. which none of these other things, it distorts, it destroys. It's a fit instrument for totalitarianism, not for Republican government. I was going to say that and see whether you agreed. And the things that this 80s has come, first of all, this immense misunderstanding of the very principle of government, with all these presidents running to be the head of something they're denouncing. And then you got the principle of Congress is very strong this summer. You know, they're playing against the Oliver Norton and all these characters. Congress is interferes with governing the country. That's the whole, that's encouraged. And And it's a deep violation of the original capacity.
Well, let's, are you getting ready to close?
Yeah.
I was going to close by saying, I started the discussion by saying if the original intent were being observed, we would be looking around for who should be the electors from Virginia and Maryland. Even prior to that, if the kind of discontents that were expressed by me and picked up by some this afternoon, we might even be thinking back to those days when they decided to have a gathering in Annapolis to consider the what was wrong with the Articles of Confederation, and Maryland didn't even send a representation to its own state capital, but somehow out of Annapolis they got a vote to hold a gathering in Philadelphia, and somehow they persuaded, miracle of miracles, George Washington to agree to go and preside over it, which gave it the necessary luster. And then they locked themselves in a closed room without air conditioning over a hot summer and under strictest admonitions from Washington, others, they didn't let a single leak out of that room until they had finished the document and they created a constitution. Suppose we really felt 200 years later that we really needed to go back and get out the pencil and draft anew, that the Articles of Confederation too have not quite, do not quite meet the needs of the 21st century that's breathing down our necks. How in the hell would we do it? How could we hold a closed session in Philadelphia or anywhere else? The TV people would be saying that every amendment to the Constitution was being violated. And of course, if you had television coverage, the most you could hope for was abortion and prayer in schools. I mean, that would, we would have a new Constitution that had that in the preamble. So it sounds like I'm saying you can't get there from here, Ken.
Maybe you've helped us think that we ought to stay where we are or try something else. But I know I speak for all of you. We continued our discussion longer, but that's a tribute to the thoughtfulness of Doug Cater. He's could have spoken at equal length as I heard him, at least not quite the length, his task at Washington College.
Oh, yeah.
If some of you want to hear a little more of that or extend your questions after the session, why, I know he'd be pleased to visit with you. It's a real privilege to have Doug.